That first day of the first season, series of Man Like Mowgli was a mess. We had no, I had no idea what was doing.
Proceed. The magic is released. For the first time ever. On Disney DVD.
I think there's something written here, but it's hard to make out.
Why? 10,000 years will give you
welcome
such
to episode
a crick
8
in the
of
neck.
The Rusted Podcast with me, Shaf Chowdhury, and
me, Sadia Habib.
Sadia, can you believe it's episode 8 already?
I really can't believe it.
It's not only are we on episode 8, but people are actually listening to us talk.
They are indeed. They're listening, they're feeding back. It's brilliant.
We've had some absolutely brilliant feedback from the Rami special, and the most recent one is the interview with Professor Evelyn Al-Sultani.
I know, I was such a fangirl in that episode. I was literally stunned that we were speaking to her.
She's absolutely brilliant. She's so articulate, and it was fascinating to hear all the academic work she's done. And, you know, she's got this new challenge now at the University of South California. And it was so interesting to hear from her, some of the research she's done. And it was absolutely crazy that she was friends with Dr. Jack Shaheen.
I know. I just hearing her stories and her stories about how they worked together and so on, and she counted him as a friend. And she's carrying on with his legacy, isn't she? She's continuing all that hard work that he did on representation about Muslims and Arabs in film and television. Mm. And her work's so powerful, hence we draw on it in our own workshops.
Definitely. She's definitely one of our heroes. And also the Rami episode with Sahar Jahani, that went down a storm because that went everywhere.
That was phenomenal. And that really hit the USA market, didn't it? Because you were looking at our stats and you said, wow, it's going quite viral in the USA.
Yeah, yeah. I think predominantly the past hour listenership has been very UK focused. And there's been a long tail of listeners in the UAE, in Algeria. We're big in Algeria, we're a big deal.
Really?
We are a big deal in Algeria.
You never told me that.
I'm just looking at the stats now. And also now, over nearly a quarter of our listenership is in the US now, which is great, which is really good to see that we're going international, Sadia. and also another quick stat is that the Rami episode is our second most listened to episode.
The first episode.
Yeah, that's right. The intro to the pod, the wrist test, and very quickly the Rami episode has shot up. I've had probably two or three people send really detailed feedback on that episode, which is brilliant. I mean, when I say detailed, it's like I think I showed you a couple of them, that pages and pages of notes about what they things that they discovered, things that they liked, questions that they wished that we asked, and that kind of stuff. It was really, really, really good. Yeah, so we've both been really busy, haven't we? We've been in a number of little adventures together, haven't we? We've been down to Norwich.
Oh, yes, that was amazing. So we went to meet the awesome Zahra, who's a PhD student in Iranian cinema at University of East Anglia. In fact, she's just submitted, so a big congratulations to Zahra, and I'm sure she's going to kill her viva, absolutely smash it.
She's got total
faith in her. So she very, very kindly invited us down to Norwich to talk all about the wrist test to her colleagues and other students and academics. And we met some brilliant people, didn't we?
We got invited down to deliver a presentation. We did the keynote. It was the keynote session, wasn't it?
We did, yeah.
And that was recorded by CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Company, which is, I think that's a story for another day, isn't it?
That definitely is, yeah. But that was really, that's great that they're interested in the RIS test. They've been in touch with us for a long time, asking us if they can come and speak to us, interview us, talk to us about the RIS test. So this was a perfect opportunity. They also got to speak to Zahra. So let's see what happens with that.
Definitely. So I really enjoyed going down there. We also recorded Well, I went down to London to visit the Muslim Vibe offices.
You did?
Salim and everyone, Nuri and Salim and everyone at the Muslim Vibe offices. And I recorded a podcast episode with them on their podcast. And also I recorded a video just explaining what the risk test is. And that was, first of all, super cringe because I'm not someone who's normally in front of a camera. But that video has gone everywhere. I've got people who know me from uni and from previous jobs who have said, oh, I've seen that video, Shaf, it's really good. And I'm like, oh, I'm like,
you think it is really good? Can you stop using the word cringe about that video? Because I've seen you writing that on social media too, and it's so not cringe. Nobody used the word cringe about it except you. Everybody else was delighted by the video. It was an awesome video, and that's why it went viral.
No, thank you. That's very kind. But I think when you see
Natural. You're a natural. I know you feel like you've been catapulted in front of the camera, but you've got it. You've got it.
You're gassing me.
On screen.
You know what it is? It's when you see yourself on screen that you think, oh gosh, look at that. Look at the bags under my eyes. I actually had a cold at the time. And
next time we'll get you a facial, don't worry.
Thank you. Yeah, and I need makeup next time because I'm not going on looking like that again.
Did they not put makeup on you, actually? They should do, you know, because they do normally, don't they, in these when you're having these on-screen interviews.
Yeah. I blew my nose in the toilet, but that was about it. That was about the extent of my treatment. But they did treat me for food afterwards, which was nice. They were really, really great bunch, mashallah, a really great bunch.
They seem like it. They seem very supportive. So thank you to the Muslim Vibe for supporting the risk test.
100%. And you've been really busy as well, haven't you, Sadia?
I have, yeah. I went to a symposium organised by another brilliant supporter of the RIS test, Dr. Roa Ali, who's at Manchester University in CODE, the CODE, the Centre for... I always forget the acronym, but it's called CODE anyway for short. Her and Professor Bridget Byrne had organised a workshop called Strategies of Survival, and we met some brilliant people there. We met writers and actors and filmmakers, sculptors, social activists who were also doing lots of creative work, curators and so on. And they all came and basically discussed what it's like to be a person of colour working in the creative industry, mm-hmm. and the challenges, you know, some of the successes. So my slot, I was there with two hats. So I talked about my new role, which is at Manchester Museum, and that's all about engaging young people with heritage and culture. And history and exploring that, you know, sense of identity and belonging, basically all the themes that, you know, I love, I'm interested in. So I talked about my new role there, but also I talked about the risk test, and everyone, and I was really surprised because they were all really, there's a few people who'd actually heard of the risk test already, and they were dying to know more about it and keen to know more about it. So that was really positive. So yes, they were genuinely interested. It was brilliant. And I will be keeping in touch with some of these people in terms of my museum role, but also in terms of discussing the RIS test with anybody else who's interested.
Awesome.
And what about yourself? What have you been up to?
Yeah, so I've been busy. I've just switched jobs and I'm learning a new... This is to get into the tech a little bit. I'm learning a new tech stack, which is always exciting. And I'm recently, you know, and I won't go into that. I won't go into too much detail because I don't want to bore you with the tech side. Yeah. But one thing I did do, what I have been up to, I've been doing a lot of research into, as you know, I've been doing a lot of personal research into biased algorithms and machine learning and AI and that kind of thing. And one thing that I found, I mean, I found lots of things that are interesting, but something that was very pertinent to the risk test and the work that you and I are doing is that, just to be technical for just a couple of minutes, well, just a minute, is that AI systems, they have to learn, right? Artificial intelligence needs to learn from something, right? It needs like a base level of understanding, and that's what machine learning is. So AI works based on machine learning, and you need to kind of seed the machine to learn from, you need to give it some data to learn from. And what I've learned is that what people do, they give these algorithms and these machine learning algorithms lots of text to learn from. Are you still with me?
Yeah.
Right. And
yep.
And what I found is that one of the biggest corpuses of text out there are movie subtitles.
Oh, wow.
And movie subtitles work really well for machine learning, and especially voice-activated systems, is because they're all conversations.
Yeah.
So a subtitle will be question and answer or a narrative or whatever it is. So it works really, really well for this forum. So when you're training a system like Siri or Alexa or any of them, the Google Assistant or anything like that, it needs to learn how to understand human language and then to generate, and that's called NLU, natural language understanding, and NLG, natural language generation. And the computer scientists out there are using movie subtitles to kind of train systems about how to conduct conversations. And it makes you think, actually, if you're seeding these systems with conversations that from films that are problematic, it makes you think, well, what kind of biases are we baking into these algorithms?
And
moving beyond the RIS test, it's gender, it's race, it's class, it's all of these really, really interesting, things that, and I went down a rabbit hole, and I think there's a PhD out there for someone to do, not me, but it's
for you.
Definitely not. But someone needs to do some research into this. I mean, I'm going to do some research too, and I think it will probably form a part of our workshop. But that's what I've been up to, and
That's absolutely brilliant.
I'll end the technical talk there. But
No. You've explained it really well, and it's really important, like you said. And there's a lot going on about that at the moment. In terms of other social categories, like you mentioned, gender and so on. There was a book that came out recently. I can't remember the name, about algorithms and gender bias.
There's algorithms of oppression.
Yeah.
And I'll put these in the show notes. There's algorithms of oppression. There's technically wrong. And there's a book that I've just finished, actually. It's a new book, and the book is called Talk to Me. And it's by a chap called James, I think it's Vlahos. It's Vlahos. And he's written a deep dive analysis of Apple, Google, and Amazon and the race for the voice-controlled AI ecosystem. And it's a fascinating book. But it's something that I'm definitely going to take a lot more research into. And I definitely think it'll be forming part of one of our workshops, because I think people don't quite understand the implications of what's going on.
I really like the way our RIS test hobby and our RIS test work often relates to our careers and our work that we do outside of the RIS test, and how it all intersects. Because, like with my role at the museum, it's all about, like I said, it's all about engaging young people. But also what I like about the museum at the moment, I've started at a very exciting time. There's a new director at the museum. She started about a year ago, and she's championing social action, community, inclusivity, imagination, and those kinds of values. So they're doing really exciting things, and they're all about change. They're all about doing new things. There's a lot of investment going on in the museum at the moment. Half the museum's closed, but in the next 2 years it's going to be developed. There's a new South Asia gallery coming. So she's really excited about doing new initiatives, being more open, and working with the diverse communities in Manchester. So I think one of the things, you didn't come to it, but one of the things that the museum held recently was a massive iftar. And about 500 people came, people from different faiths, and it was really powerful. At a time where you've got Muslims who feel that they can't visibly show their Muslimness, they can't really pray in public and so on because of rising Islamophobia, because of racism, but there were, you know, encouraged to pray. And so they opened their fast and they prayed Maghrib together in Jamaat in the museum.
Yeah, wow, that sounds great.
Yeah. under the dinosaur, under Stan. It was really phenomenal. The pictures are stunning. So it's really nice to see how Islamophobia is being tackled in different arenas.
Yeah, no, that's an absolutely fascinating, and I'm gutted that I wasn't there for that. But I can't remember what it was. I had something on it. Otherwise, I definitely would have been there.
I know you would have done, but inshallah, next year.
Inshallah, we are working on a top secret project, aren't we, with the museum?
Yes.
So we'll talk about that another time, I think. But that's exciting, I think. But, so what's happened in the world, Sadia? We've had a few things that we've discussed together. The first one being the new Aladdin real world remake. I don't know what the right term is.
Yeah. Do you know anybody who's seen it?
Well, you know Anissa, who recorded Anissa from Traumas Over Flowers, she wrote a really great review, and again, I'll put this in the show notes. And she watched it, and she thinks it passes the Riz test, and she wrote a review on it, and it's really good. And again, I'll put the review so that everyone can read it, and I'll put it in Twitter on our Twitter account. But yeah, she said it was good. She enjoyed it. So, Sadie, have you seen it?
I haven't seen it, and I have been wanting to boycott it, but I've got friends and family who have seen it, and they've been encouraging me to watch it. And Ghulam even said to me, my husband even said to me, "Oh, I think you should watch it so you can risk test it." I think my biggest fear is, remember that we've had Aladdin risk tested before, the old Aladdin, the original, and you've got, you know, that horrific song in there.
Yes.
With the line, something about they'll cut your ear off, but it's barbaric, but hey, it's home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so on. But yeah, I read all about, I haven't seen it yet, but I've read all about it, and I've seen that a lot of people are saying it's much better than, and commending this new one for taking that barbaric line out, for example. But at the same time, I've seen a lot of criticism of it, saying that it's still depicting Arabs and Muslims as the other, and at a time when you've got, you know, Trump and rising Islamophobia, this is not helpful for Muslims. So I even read somewhere, I'm sure the Council on American Islamic Relations, also known as CAIR, wrote an article very recently on their website where they also critique it and say it's still Orientalist, it's still racist, it's still Islamophobic. So
Wow.
I'm really interested in those more critical views of it. I know people think it's fun and it's harmless and it's just entertainment, but I just worry when we're not being
Critical enough.
Critical enough. And I think we owe it to ourselves to be more critical. So let's see. I think we should watch
We
it.
should. We definitely should give it a watch, and then
Even though I don't want to, I'm really every like, you know, I'm so resistant to watching it. I don't want to watch it.
think of it as an academic exercise. Don't watch it. I'll be sat there singing along to all the songs, and then you'll be there, give me dirty looks. How about that? But
So I'm interested to chat to Nisa to see why she thinks it passes, because I think it's going to be one of those shows that some people will say it doesn't pass.
well, let's see what people come back with. So far, Anissa said it passes, and let's see what other people have got to say about it. It's interesting. The debate is very interesting. In other news, Rami, we had the Rami special with Sarah Jahani, and we were discussing potentially that being, you know, the hope of that being renewed, and it has been renewed, right?
Yes. So is there a second series? When is the second series being filmed?
I don't know if it's been filmed yet, but it's definitely recommissioned, which is really great to see, because Rami is one of those shows that has really split opinions. It's really divided people's opinions, especially some of the feedback that we've received. Some people think it normalizes certain behaviors. Some people said it just reflects the reality of the world we're living in. But so far, it's been a really great. Well, it's certainly represented Muslims in a much more nuanced way than previously we've seen. But we'll see how the characters developed in season two, especially with some of the more peripheral characters coming to the front. That'd be really interesting to see.
It will definitely, and hopefully we can get. I mean, it was amazing having Saha talk to us about the, you know, the whole the writer's room and how all that works, how all that operates, and all those insights into making a show like Rami. So it'd be great to get some of her colleagues or some other cast or even Rami on the show.
Definitely. Well, yeah, that's 100%. We've emailed him, but we'll see what happens. So Sadia, we had the absolute pleasure of chatting to Mr. Tez Ilyas recently, didn't we?
We did indeed. He was brilliant. He's a household name, isn't he? And yet he's so humble.
He is.
And I like the way he's very true to his northern roots.
Yeah.
It was awesome that he agreed to come on and speak to us and talk about how he got into writing and performing and his motivations for doing comedy.
He was talking about his journey on Man Like Mabeen and talking about Guz Khan and all of that. But do you know the funny thing is the reason that he agreed to join us on our podcast is because I just called him out on Twitter. I said, look, he think he liked one of our tweets. And I came back with, Tez, brother, I do the brother card. I said, Tez, brother, when are you going to join us on our podcast? Why with? Well, let's make it happen. Which led to DMs, which led to number swapping, which led to us sat in a meeting room with him and having a lovely time.
He's so down to earth.
Super down to earth.
Really political as well, which is, I think it's so important. I saw a tweet today from Guz Khan. I can't remember the exact words, but he shares When They See Us by Ava DuVernay. You know, the new Netflix documentary.
Yep.
About what really happened, the horrific racial injustice and what happened to those boys. And he shares that and he absolutely applauds Ava DuVernay and says, this is what you need to do when you're if you're a creative professional, this is the kind of thing you should be doing, speaking truth to power. And so Guz Khan and Tez Ilyas, I really like their, not just their work, you know, in terms of the humour and them becoming household names because they are so humorous and so funny and entertaining, but also they keep it real. They realize that you can't just be neutral. If you're in positions of power, you must speak up against injustices. So without any further ado, let's hear more from Tez.
So we are joined, we have the pleasure of the company of Mr. Tehzeeb Ilyas.
Yes, Muhammad Tehzeeb Ilyas, please. otherwise known as?
Tez Ilyas.
Thank you.
So Tehzeeb to Tez. Why the change from Tehzeeb to Tez in terms of your stage name?
I mean, isn't it obvious? Like, no one can pronounce Tehzeeb. There's a funny story behind my name, actually, because I was... So my mum's puppy, my mum's aunt, she called me Tehzeeb. Mm-hmm. That was her choice. And Muhammad just went in front of it because, you know, that's what we do. So that went on the birth certificate, but my mum hated it. It just immediately just hated the name, Tehzeeb. So she always called me Tahir.
Really?
So everyone in Blackman calls me Tahir or Terry.
Right.
Terry. And it was only when I went to school that I found out that my name is Tehzeeb.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
High school?
No, primary school.
Oh, few.
But even then, it was kind of like, I was like, but why does everyone call me? I just thought it was a weird thing. I remember when I was in Pakistan, not when I was young, probably when I was like 18, 19, I was talking to my uncles and it just came up and I was like, yeah, my name's not Tahir, you know. And they were like, fuck off. my name's Tehzeeb. They were like, no, it's not.
Yeah, yeah.
They were like, they had no idea.
Oh, wow.
That Tahir wasn't my name.
So how did your puppy win then in the end, in that battle?
I just think because she was an elder, she just like, oh, Tehzeeb's a nice name. Mm-hmm. And then my mom was like, right. And then she probably thought about it for longer than a day and thought, bloody hate that name.
Yeah, but by that time the ink was already dry in the booth.
Yeah, that'd been done, innit?
Have you met any other Tehzeebs?
No, I googled it though, and I think it means like polite, well mannered, but there's also a Bollywood film called Tehzeeb, and I was like, great. So it's really good to have things named after you, innit? Like, he's got this podcast named after him. The thing about having things named after you, I've got this film named after me, not after me, but you know, it's got this, I can pretend it does. And then I read the plot of the film, and this is genuinely the first few lines of the Wikipedia page plot line of the film Tehzeeb. Anwar and Rukhsana had been married for years, right? It's quite sweet so far. However, Anwar commits suicide, plot twist, after falling into a deep depression following the birth of his daughter, Tezeeb.
Is this a big film? Was this like a big Hollywood, film?
It wasn't like one of the big films, but it was a big film. Yeah, I've forgotten the name of the actress, but she's quite big though, or she was at least at the time. So the film's about 15 years old now, so it's not like a new
film.
Have
you actually seen the film?
No, I'm not going to watch after that. So it turns out I've got, and then some people all send me pictures and stuff. There's a bakery in Pakistan called Tezeeb.
Oh.
And someone found another shop called Tezeeb, and it was a women's fashion shop, and it was called Tezeeb, and I was like, I know I've got a girl's name, all right.
Well, there's a lot of women out there wearing Tezeeb.
Well, probably not a lot, but probably about 4 or 5, yeah. But well, it's like Mobeen. Like, Mobeen is a unisex name.
Yes, it is. I've got a cousin called Mobeen.
Yeah. Not even Mobeena.
No, just Mobeen straight up.
Well, what's interesting, Tez, is that we discussed this on the way in, that I've been following your work for a long time now, a number of years.
Yeah.
And it's been great to see your career go from strength to strength. And it feels like it's at an inflection point that you're really going to go huge now. Inshallah, we hope so.
Inshallah, yeah. We'll see.
God willing. But it would be great to hear the kind of origin story of Tez Ilyas, because what's interesting is that you did a biomedical science degree, right? And a master's. Now, what I wanted to know as well was that, did you always want to be a comedian? And did you do that to appease mum and dad? Or did you do that and did you fall into comedy? Which came first?
Okay, I had zero plans to be a comedian. Right. Zero. Like, I grew up in a 2 up 2 down in Blackburn, you know, very working class, insular Asian community. The idea of being a comedian, if you said that to me at 16, back in the 90s or whatever, you might as well have said to me, you're going to become an astronaut. It was so far removed from any experience that I had or any experience of anyone that I knew. That just the idea of that would have just been a fantasy. So no, I had zero idea going into the art. So like, I enjoyed drama at high school, but yeah. I dropped it at 14. You know, when you're making choices for GCSE, didn't do it after 14 because, you know, I thought there was no way I was gonna ever pursue that. I just did a bit of fun. I did a bachelor's in biochemistry at Lancaster Uni, and then a master's in management. Because A, I didn't want to create science because I kind of fell out of love with it, and B, I didn't want to leave uni. So, so I did a master's in management. And then I got on the graduate program of the civil service called the Fast Stream.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I'm aware of that,
Very hard and competitive, but I managed to get on. And that took me to London. And then I started working in the Home Office. That's the parent department that they put me in. And I started working there. And then, so I spent a year in London, and then I came back up and I did 2 years, one in Liverpool, one in Burnley. And then I went back to London at the beginning of 2010. And I went back and I thought, I don't want to make the same mistakes that I made when I moved there the first time for a year, because it's a very lonely place. Like, there's 8 million people there, but it's, you know, it's not like the North where everyone's really friendly and everyone kind of knows everyone. You want the community around you. Yes. I had no family there. I had a few friends from union stuff, but it's not like in the movies where everyone lives in the same apartment. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, everyone's scattered all over the place. Like, London is no, like the south of the Northwest. It's such a big place.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, I want to find a hobby. I want to find something to do in the evenings, just spend my time and maybe meet some people as well. So I started looking online for a writing workshop. Oh. You know, everyone's got this idea in their head that they've got a funny story to tell. And I thought, oh, I'll put that to paper, see what happens. Just a hobby, just a writing exercise. So I started looking for creative writing courses, and I found a stand-up workshop online. And this was through City Lit College, it's an adult college in central London. And I looked at it and I thought, oh, you know, my friends tell me I'm funny. I believe them. I'm a sucker. And I thought, worst case scenario, I'd meet new people and I'd make a fool of myself. I can live with both those things.
And
I was thinking about this the other week, because I thought, it's funny that I was in that place at that time, in that mindset, to actually click yes to going on this thing, because it was £130, and at the time I was knee-board in student debt and knee-deep in student debt, and I thought, it's a lot of money, £130 to me at the time.
Yeah.
Now I'm balling, it's not, but at the time it was a lot of money and stuff, and I thought to myself, do I really want to do this? But just at that moment I was like, yeah, but I thought to myself, if I just paid a big bill that day, or I'd had a big bill coming up or something, I might have gone, nah, it's too much. I can't justify it. But just get some money in it.
Yep.
It's fate. I clicked yes. So I went on this thing. It was one day a week for 6 weeks. So like a workshop. So it doesn't teach you how to be funny, but it teaches you the mechanics of stand-up and starts giving you some writing exercises and really starts opening your mind up to the possibility of comedic connections and stories, funny stories that you might want to turn into a stand-up routine. So every week we got homework to write a 2-minute monologue effectively that we then presented back the following week. Remember the first week it was just write about something that makes you angry.
Mm-hmm.
Not apoplectic, but you know, like something. Yeah. You know those things that you get unjustly annoyed about?
Yeah.
And I just wrote a probably very unfunny monologue, if I look back on it now, about Facebook and how people use LOL and stuff like that. Oh. Like it was awful. Like, it was awful. But, you know, that's what was... This got me started. That was the first thing that I wrote. It was 2 minutes. And then I performed it back. I think probably got a couple of titters, if that. And then you get feedback from the tutor who was like, oh, have we tried this? Have we tried that? And then you listen to everyone else and you also give feedback on everyone else's thing. Yeah. There must have been like 12, 15 people in the class.
What was the kind of make of that class?
It was so diverse. There was black lady, a couple of Asian lads, and then I think more or less everyone else was white, but also different ages, backgrounds. Like a couple of people really young, a couple of people a bit older, some married, had kids, and some of it was just, I just want something to give me a bit of confidence.
Yeah.
Have you kept in touch with the City Lit group and the tutor?
No. The tutor a little bit. He was a comedian who stopped doing it called Rob Hitchmoff. Great guy. I don't know what he does now, to be honest, but he was a comedian on the circuit for a while. I think he kind of stopped by the time he was teaching, because I never gigged with him. And there's a really funny, the black lady, Susie Wilde, is really funny. She was on the circuit. She's on the circuit on and off.
All right.
The rest of them, no. There's one guy called Noah who was hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Like, every week he just cracked us up on me. We all thought to ourselves, this guy's going to fucking make it. He's brilliant. But he just never did. Just never got into it. Or I think, like, some people really like writing, but they don't like performing.
Right.
I think he was one of those cases.
Which do you prefer, writing or performing?
Performing, I think. I like writing, like, when it works. Like, you know, when you write something and you're like, this is great. Yeah. Like, this is going to work.
Yeah.
I don't like writing when it's like, oh, I can't fix this. Like, you know, like when you get stuck in a rut.
Yeah.
I hate that.
Do you get writer's block?
Yeah. Like, I'm definitely a performer writer, not a writer performer. Because you're a writer performer. I'm a performer writer.
Uh-huh.
So, like, I write to perform. I don't just write for the sake of writing.
No, that's fascinating. And I think, you know, with comedy and writing and stuff, I think the cliche is always write about what you know.
Yeah.
Speak about what you know.
Yeah, definitely.
And you've really embraced that in terms of you speak very openly and frankly about your identity as a British Muslim. And that's interesting because I've seen your TEDx Manchester talk, and I wasn't there, I couldn't get tickets, but also I've seen you live at the Apollo and all the things. You really embrace your identity. A question is that, do you find that the audiences that you speak with, do you think that they are getting increasingly more woke? Because there are some jokes you make, instead of saying OMG, you say
OMA.
Yeah. You don't explain that, but it gets a laugh because people.
It isn't always.
Oh, really?
No, it isn't always. It's funny. Sometimes the audience get it immediately.
Yeah.
They're on board.
Mm-hmm.
Other times they'll get it in drips and drops, like oh, and you can hear the room just getting a slightly different tone. I don't know. Some gigs were just like they've just gone. What? why is he paused?
Yeah. Did you have to spell it out then? Literally spell it.
No, I don't. Like, if they don't get it, they don't get it. Okay. I don't.
They're hard luck.
Yeah, I don't explain it to them. I'm like, it's for the people who know what it is.
Yeah. If you know, you know. Hashtag.
Yeah.
I hate that hashtag, by the way.
It's like, and also, you can hear people explain. You can see people explaining it to their friends, and their friends going, which I like.
But that's a different type of reaction, isn't it? I guess that's gratifying as well.
Mm.
From you know, just seeing it land, but eventually people kind of get it.
I always like comedy that was a little bit. Don't get me wrong, I love slapstick.
Yeah.
Like, I like all different types of comedy, but the type of comedy that I prefer the most is the comedy that makes you think a little bit.
Mm.
That's always what I gravitated towards, which is why I love Chris Rock and Dave Chappelle and other comics like Stuart Lee and comics like that. So that is always what I gravitated towards. So it's kind of like, that's the sort of comedian I want to be.
Yeah.
So when I can drop in references that I'm like, these are for the people who get it.
Yeah.
I don't cultural need to. I don't. I, yeah. And even a lot of the stuff that I say, I leave a lot in the subtext.
Yes.
Like, I never, like, when I'm saying Jesus is a vice captain, I don't explain what that means, because I'm like, if you know what that means, you know what it means. If you don't, you might look it up.
Yeah.
Or if you don't, fine, don't worry about it. I never want to overexplain myself because I always want to be funnier than I am interesting.
Okay.
So if you came to see my show, I'd want you to go away thinking, that was hilarious. You know what? It made me think a little bit as well, yeah. Rather than, that was so fascinating. You know what? I chuckled a couple of times. Yeah. Like, I'd always want it to be the first way around. Yeah, I'd always want you to think it's funny.
You want it to be a lecture. You want it to
Exactly. I'm a comedian.
Yeah.
So my job is, first and foremost, primarily, my job as a comedian is to make, at least when I'm doing a comedy gig, is to make people laugh. If I can then underlay that with some subtext about, you know, about things that I want people to think about, I will do that.
What kinds of things do you want people to think about?
Well, I want to humanize British Muslims, because I know for a lot of people, their only experience of British Muslims is what they might see on the news or read in the papers, and obviously that is only 90% of who we are. So there's
10%. That's you being generous.
Yeah, and there's, you know, 10% maybe you're just normal human beings.
Yeah.
So occasionally, you know, we just go shopping and eat food. So yeah,
once a fortnight.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when we're not on Ramadan. So I want people to, you know, like, yeah, I want to humanize us a little bit and people to go. Well, actually, something like at university, I had a friend called Eddie Jordan from Halifax, and this guy I lived with for 4 years. He's sort of person I just get put with accidentally. We just lived in the same house in the first year. And we just lived with each other for 4 years, and we just became really, really close. And I remember when we left on the last day, like at the graduate ball or something, he said to me, "You know, if I'd never met you, I think I'd be racist."
Oh, really?
Yeah, so he said to me.
That's pretty profound.
And I found that fascinating.
Yeah.
And that's always stayed with me.
And what ethnicity was he? He was just white guy.
Yeah. And I just found that fascinating, that actually when you meet people, when you have a reference point, it changes everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think when you, generally speaking, when people think of abstract terms of Muslims or British Muslim, they can't connect. But when it is my mate Tez, or the guy I went to uni with, or Sadia I study with, or, you know, whatever, or Shafiq who fixes my computer, you know, they make it personal. It's a personal thing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's,
I've got a question. Do you have any difficulties in terms of, so you know, your Muslimness, you're so open about it, alhamdulillah, and you're really confident about your identity as a comedian. What kind of difficulties do you perhaps encounter on this journey where you're a Muslim comedian?
You know, alhamdulillah, to say, at least overtly, none. If there are people who have been prejudiced against me, they're doing it behind my back.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't say that's never happened, because you don't know what people are doing behind your back. That's the point of it, being behind your back. But overtly, either if people are prejudiced, they're smart enough to know that it's unacceptable to say that to me, or they're just not.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping it's the majority of it, I think, is the latter. I think people are very open. I think also in comedy, when you're in the arts, you're kind of at the forefront of progressive culture, whether that be race or sexuality, or you know I've learned a lot on this journey, like hanging out with people from different walks of life, and definitely changed my views on certain things. I definitely believe in a greater equality for women than I probably did back in 2010, and really that's something that Islam advocated for as well, but my culture didn't. So just really interesting what you learn on this journey, and you think, oh, actually my religion teaches that. So that's not so weird. But alhamdulillah, no, I have to say there have been times where I thought, oh, has this thing happened because I'm Muslim?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you.
But thinking like that, I think I'm mindful of it, but I don't express it publicly, and I never complain about it. Because I think it's counterproductive.
Mm.
Because I think unless you're part of the group that is being targeted, you're not mindful of those small nuances.
Mm.
You only notice the big things. So because I'm not a woman, I don't notice the minutia of sexism that women have every single day.
Yeah.
But if you were to complain about every single one of those little things that you go through, eventually people would stop listening.
Yeah.
It would become counterproductive. Yeah. So that's why when I have a thing that, unless it's really overt and something that I can pinpoint concretely and say that that's what happened and it was wrong.
Yeah, you have to pick your battles.
Yeah, I kind of just let it slide, or I note it in my mind and go, okay, that might have been that, but I can't prove it, and I don't want to be the boy who cries wolf.
I'm just wondering, does it irk you? Me and Shaf were talking about this earlier. Does it irk you to be known as a Muslim comedian? Do you want to just be a comedian?
Well, I think I am, because I think I am just a comedian because I'm on the yeah, because it's quite. I think it's a little bit reductive, because no one calls McIntyre the middle class comedian.
Yeah, yeah, and he is the quintessential
middle class comedian. Yeah, you know, he's an observational comedian, but that's a genre of comedy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Muslim comedian is not a genre of comedy.
No.
You know, satirist or storyteller or observational humor. You know, those are. You know, I have a lot of different styles that I kind of express through my comedy, but I don't think Muslim comedian is a type of comedy. It's not a genre.
Yeah, that's interesting, because the previous podcast we speak with Soap and Deb, who's a stand-up comedian and also a writer for the New York Times, and he interviewed Hasan Minhaj on stage, and he asked him, on Patriot Act, his Netflix show, he makes references to Muslim things such as, you know, using the lota and that kind of stuff, and he doesn't bother to explain it. He just moves on. He's very open and embraces his Muslim identity, just as you do. And he asks him, are you worried that some of those jokes won't land? And Hasan's response was, well, that question is not asked to like Jimmy Fallon, and you know, when they make a joke that's only targeted to a small number of people, then he's not asked, well, are you worried that not everyone will understand that joke? And you're saying the same thing, you know.
Yeah, completely.
It's being funny is being funny, right?
Exactly. And I'm on the same circuit that McIntyre came up on, that Sarah Millican came up on, that all of my non-Muslim comedian friends are on. I'm on the exact same circuit. I do the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. I do all the comedy clubs across the country. I also have this identity, which means I can work in areas that maybe they can't work in.
Yeah.
But, you know, then I'm not doing a beer festival.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's allowed me to do and have opportunities that other people don't have. But it's not a genre of comedy.
Do you get invited to do beer festivals and such and places where you think?
I have done, yeah, because a lot of times we want to put on a comedian, and sometimes I will go and do it because I'm like, well, the whole point of me doing this is because I'm a comedian who thinks, like, there are probably, the only probably stage that I wouldn't perform on is something that would advocate, like, for the far right.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I wouldn't do, like, a BNP fundraiser or something like that. But, you know, other than that, I would happily jump on a case-by-case basis. So don't quote me on this. But I would jump on more stages, yeah.
But that's what happened, isn't it? I think, is it the EDL or Britain First? They booked a comedian and he turned out to be black.
Hilarious.
And I think that you couldn't write that stuff, really.
Hilarious.
Or maybe you could.
Hilarious.
Even
if they booked me, like, they didn't realise who I was,
yeah,
I would be tempted to go. Because I'm like, something might happen. This might be the start of something the rest of my career. But
spectacular, can you imagine?
Well, the interesting thing is that you're telling your story. And as you said before, you know, it's not a genre of comedy being British Muslim comedy. You're just a comedian telling your story.
Yeah, like all comedians, like, that's the biggest, as you said it before, the biggest thing in comedy is say what you know, speak about what you know. And there's not a lot of me on the circuit.
Exactly.
So that's my USP. It'd be foolish of me to try and compete with McIntyre and talk about toasters. And he makes that very, very funny. I can't make that stuff as funny as he can make it. I probably can't make it funny at all. But then he can't satirise the way that I do. So.
Yeah.
So we're all just in our lanes trying to do what we're good at.
Yeah.
How did you get in? Cause I'm thinking about other comedians as well, like Guz Khan. How did you get involved in Man Like Mubeen?
So Guz reached, weirdly, so 2015, we both got commissioned short films by the BBC for Ramadan. And I made The Fast and the Fool, and he made the one he made with the guy from Scottish sitcom, I've forgotten. And then we just got in touch with each other because we were like, oh, you're doing that, I'm doing that. Oh, cool, it'd be nice to meet up one day, you know. And then he did the Pachysaurus thing, he went to Babar, and I was like, that's the guy that I was talking to. I was like, oh, man, this guy's hilarious, because I didn't really see much of him, because, you know, I'm not... Because before that, I think he was doing a lot on, like, YouTube and Instagram and stuff like that, and it's not really where... I don't think I'm the right target audience for that sort of thing. And I saw him on, I saw that and I was like, this is hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
And then it, I think it came to the Comedy Store because I was doing a gig, one that Imran Yusuf, halal comedy, and yeah, and then he introduced himself at the end, and we just got on really well, and we stayed in touch, and then we met up a couple of more times, and then I got commissioned another short film by Sky that Christmas, for Christmas, and that was sort of December 2015.
Yeah,
and so I put him in that. And then he got commissioned the pilot for Man Like Morbi from BBC, so he put me in that. And then when that went to series, obviously he was in it because it's a show, but I was the only thing that stayed in from the pilot. It completely changed my character. So I wasn't playing the same person that was in the pilot because they changed the script, that story completely and start again. But like the BBC liked me and because of me and Guz's chemistry, they were like, well, we'll keep him in, obviously we'll change what the role is. And then that's when I became 8. And then we just get on so well because he's similar to me, like working class Asian, white insular community, and there's not a lot, even there's a lot of Muslims, not a lot, but there's a few Muslims on the circuit, there's a lot of Asians on the circuit, but that particular overlap, there's only me and Guz.
Really?
So when we met each other, it was like he was my cousin. It was like I'd met my cousin.
Yeah.
Like, we just got on so well. And that shorthand, you don't need to explain stuff to each other. Yeah. We have similar outlook on life. We have similar politics. We have a similar sense of humour. Yeah. Shared experiences. Great chemistry. Yeah. Like, we make each other laugh. I mean, we're just like, yeah, let's work with each other as much as we can.
And that comes across so well on screen because it looks like that you're both always on the verge of just losing it.
Oh, I think there's a clip in this season, Man Like Mobi.
Yeah.
That stayed in where I'm laughing because he said something and I was like, oh, that's so bad because that we should have done that take again because I'm laughing. But I think they did 10 takes and that was probably the one that was laughing the least. In. But it was in the hospital episode, if you watch it again.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That episode's fantastic.
Yeah, it was in that episode where, you know, we sat down and she's in the trolley.
Yeah.
And I'm just keep saying stuff inappropriate and she's trying to hit me.
Yeah.
There's a bit there where I start smirking.
Yeah.
Because I can't keep a straight face. But it's like, if they're like, because we're none of the trained actors.
Yeah.
So I'm not a trained actor. Girls not a trained actor. Duo's 16, so she hasn't been to drama school.
Yeah.
Tolu's a comedian as well online, so he's not a trained actor. So it's kind of like there's a lot of directing that needs to be done and a lot of like coalescing that needs to be done to get that show made. Like, it's better now because second series we're more experienced, but that first day of the first series of Man Like Morbi was a mess. I had no idea what I was doing.
Yeah.
Never acted properly. Not properly.
Yeah.
It was so much fun. I think you could probably get definitely a great blooper reel.
Really?
Out of that, just us making each other laugh.
I'd love
stuff.
To see that.
And but that's what it sounds like. It makes it more fun, doesn't it? Like being back at school or something, really drama class.
It's so relatable because your story is my story.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Mm. You know, Pakistani, British Muslim, growing up in the Northwest. And that's why I think people resonate with it so much, because when they see you and Guz playing off each other, I see myself and my friends, and I think that's why it's become such a success. I mean, people hold it so closely to the hearts. Yeah. And it's not only UK as well, because
people love it in America.
Yeah, they do. They really love it. Yeah.
In America, it was really nice. I was on a train journey from Preston to London last year after the first series, and the white guy sat a bit further down the carriage, and he kept looking at me, not in a horrible way, but just kept glancing at me, and I was like, I don't think he recognizes me, or he's acting weird. And he came over to me and I went, oh, took my headphones off. And he went, hi, mate. So I don't mean to disturb you. You're a Man Like Morbi. I went, oh, yeah, I am. And he went, oh, I love that show. Oh, my daughter loves it. Do you mind if I call her? I just want to. She won't believe me that I met you.
Oh, wow.
So he put his daughter on FaceTime. He turned the camera around and it was me. And I went, hiya, how you doing? And she just was like, oh, I can't believe it, Dad. I can't believe it. You met him, whatever. It's so sweet. It connects with people who are not from our background because it's a good comedy. And that's like, well, comedy, like, you know, I'm not, you know, I don't run a hotel, but I love Fawlty Towers.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a Cockney wide boy, but Holy Fools and Horses, the greatest to come of all time, you know. It's just
what's important about you and Guz Khan and comedians like you doing this is connecting with the youth, I think, across cultures, which I've really noticed, young people from different cultures, different religions. Because it's all about multicultural young people.
Yeah, yeah, completely. And also we grew up in maybe not the toughest neighbourhoods in the world, but, you know, we grew up with not a lot of money and, you know, a bit of hustling here and there, and our parents making sacrifices for us, and that's a universal story.
Yes, mm-hmm. It is.
And I think there's, you know, in this country, when we talk about working class, we always, the media, what they mean is white working class,
yeah.
Because mm-hmm. the majority of Asians and blacks in this country are also working class, but they're never part of that narrative. Yeah. And I think all working class communities in this country are a lot more similar to each other than they are to the people who govern us.
Yes, definitely. Most definitely.
Or the media who write about us.
The media who write about us, or the people who gentrify the areas that we live in, for example. And it's always divide and rule between the working classes, but actually that's not our battle with other working classes.
And that's, I mean, specifically on that point, when you've spoken at TEDx Manchester, you speak specifically about you're the woke, we were telling you before, you're the wokest comedian on Twitter.
That's what we think.
I know,
you don't like the word.
I'm not a fan of the word, but for want of a better
concept.
Term.
Yeah.
And it's because on the TEDx Manchester talk, you speak specifically about the Louise Casey report, and you speak specifically about Trevor Phillips' hatchet job, really. And I think that's the only way to describe his show, and, you know, Ipsos Mori polls from 2016 and whatnot. And I think, again, what's great for me to see is that you just address these things head on. You're not scared of talking about these issues that probably most Muslims are too scared about bringing up.
Thing is, I mean, because I've talked about this, we grew up in two downs in Blackburn Coventry or whatever. It's like, if they take all this away from us, we just go back home and stock shelves, isn't it? Like, we just, you know, we'll... Like, this wasn't handed to us and gone, this is your birthright to do this.
Yeah.
It's something that we fell into / earned eventually. But again, if they decided that they didn't want us or they didn't like what we were saying, we'd be like, all right, we'll just go back to what we were doing then.
Well, you've got masters to fall back on, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Or, I mean, I'm a stand-up comedian on the mainstream circuit. I just go and do that.
Mm.
And I will start writing in a way, like at the moment I'm channeling those things into the TV show that I'm trying to make.
Mm.
But if they took that away from me, then I would channel it back into my stand-up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Will there be another season of Man Like Mugabe?
Yes.
Oh,
yeah. So we've got a third series, and I can say that because we've announced it online. But it won't be out for a while. Early next year, I imagine. Because, you know, because you've got to write it, and then writing is a painful process. Like, you have no idea. And then you've got to make it and then edit it and all stuff. So it will be out probably about January, February, March next year, I think.
Oh, that's fantastic. So at the Risk Test, we speak about representation in the arts, broadly speaking, the arts. We're starting off with film and TV because it's probably the most potent art form in terms of getting the messages across. And we know it started because Muslims are so poorly represented on film and TV. Did you hear about the Risk Test before we spoke?
I think I heard about just maybe... It was tweeted into my timeline or someone or something like that.
I'm glad you said that. It would be best if you said no. I never heard about it.
I still haven't heard about it. Was it?
No, who are you?
No, it's I'd heard about it because of the. I think it'd been tweeted into my timeline.
Mm-hmm.
So
fantastic.
Yeah, and I think representation in the media is so important. I think not just for Muslims and Asians, but across society. And I think it's interesting now that there's becoming an increasing balance of representations from people who weren't previously represented that's brought out a lot of fragility in some white people.
Yes.
Yeah.
I find that fascinating
because
there's a type of white person that from one side of the mouth will talk about how PC has gone mad and how there is no racism or we overreact to racism. Mm.
We live in a post-racial world.
Yeah, or things aren't a problem. You know, racism isn't really a problem. Or, you know, of course there aren't that many black people on TV because you're 5% of the population or whatever. Yeah. You know, those people who talk like that.
Yeah.
But then the other side of the mouth, Jon Snow will say white people.
Yes.
And they lose their minds.
Yeah, we're
always racialized.
And they can't, that sense of irony just completely lost in them.
Mm-hmm.
I find that subset of white people fascinating. Mm-hmm. White people fascinating.
There's an increasing awareness of deconstructing whiteness with all the books that are coming out at the moment, and with, you know, in comedy, in film Get Out and Oz and so on. So
what's fascinated me over recent months is being counterproductive and the science of counterproductiveness. So this idea that, so first, if the thought first came to my mind when someone wanted to talk to me about God, and I was an atheist, and I was like, all right, let's have a conversation. And the first thing he said to me was, so, you know, so why do you believe in these fairy tales? And I thought to myself, this is a weird way to start a conversation, because it's not going to make me think your argument is more valid.
Yeah.
If anything, I'm thinking you're a prick, and it's going to make me believe more in what I already believe. It's going to entrench my beliefs.
Yeah.
And that's happened in, we've seen that in Brexit.
Yes.
Where if you call someone who voted Leave a racist, even if that is the reason they left, that's not what they identify as. Mm-hmm. That's not what they think about themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
Even if everything that they do or their actions point that way, that's not how they identify themselves as. If you call them a racist, it's not going to help.
No.
It's not going to change their minds. They're not going to think to themselves, oh, I better take a hard look at myself and look at all sides of this argument. They're going to think, this guy's a prick.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to, it's going to entrench further my views that I already hold. And I find that fascinating in terms of the way we talk about white people. Mm-hmm. And this subsection of white people that become more and more defensive. Mm-hmm. And because I think we are regressing in society slightly. And I think our generation, probably that 25 to 40 years old, mm-hmm. probably had it the best, I think.
Yeah.
In terms of our race relations and stuff. Because we grew up in the 90s. And I think that was post Stephen Lawrence, before 9/11.
Yeah.
That period, I think, was where everyone kind of went, okay, guys, there are racists out there. We're not going to give them a platform.
Mm.
They're not one of us. We're going to demonize them as much as we can. But then racism changed to Islamophobia.
Mm.
And suddenly, all that started rising again.
Yeah.
And they were given a platform. And they went, oh, let's just let them express themselves. Yeah. And then we defeat them in the, as Amir Rahman calls it, the marketplace of ideas.
Yeah.
Wherever that is. we're just back in the 70s and 80s again.
Yeah.
In the way that people talk about. And, you know, this shield that they have, which is Islam's not a race.
Oh, I hate that.
Which is their magic sentence. Which just allows them to get away with all sorts of nonsense that they want to say. But what I am fascinated about is what is that line where your activism becomes counterproductive?
You're right, yeah.
So for example, the environmentalist protests in London.
Yeah.
I'm on their side, mm-hmm. totally. But it doesn't matter that I'm on their side because I hold no power. To people that hold power, that's who you need to influence. And so at what point does your actions become counterproductive?
Yeah.
So it's like, does it matter because you're doing the right thing?
Yeah.
So does it matter if it's counterproductive? Because ultimately what you're doing is right. So eventually people have to listen.
Yeah, by any means.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or is there a smarter way of doing activism where you can bring people with you?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the answer, but I just find that fascinating.
It is fascinating, and I think at the beginning when you said, you know, about fairy tales, it's like engaging with someone who voted Leave. Said, well, why did you vote Leave? You're racist.
Yeah, they're gonna be like, what a fucking dick.
Yeah, and it only serves.
Sorry, I'm swearing a lot. I apologize.
So I'll beep it out. But it only goes to serve that binary, doesn't it? You know, everything's been reduced to ones and zeros. You're either with us or without us.
Mm.
You're either pro this or against that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
So I'm conscious of time. So what's next? I know that you've got the Tez O'Clock Show.
Yeah, man. So working title. I don't know if that's what it's going to end up being called. But yeah, I've been, alhamdulillah, blessed to be given a commission by Channel 4 for a late night entertainment slot in that hallowed 11 o'clock slot, which is very, very, it means a lot to comedians, that 11
p.m.
slot on Channel 4. So it's a mini commission. They initially gave me a non-TX pilot, which means not for TV pilot.
Mm-hmm.
But then they were like, oh, here's three episodes.
Oh,
so it's kind of like, it's almost like a test run.
Yeah,
so it's not one of episode where you kind of, it's difficult to kind of know what you want to do. So it's kind of like a mini run. And hopefully it goes well and we'll get a full series out of it. But yeah, that's going to be on this summer. So we're going to film it in Manchester because we want it to be a very northern show.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring a couple of friends in because to carry an hour by yourself is, with this amount of experience, which is very little, would be ridiculously a bad thing to do. So I'm going to have some friends with me on the show. And yeah, we're going to talk about things that I care about. So it's not that the show is going to be massively topical. We talk about things that people care about, but it's not going to be the sort of show where you're like, someone said this, Jacob Rees-Mogg said this on Tuesday, what do we think about that? There might be a little bit of that, but that's not going to be what the whole show is.
Sure.
And it's going to be a mixture of live studio stuff and sketches and pre-recorded sketches and VTs.
It's kind of a cross between
the Chappelle Show and maybe Russell Howard's Good News that was on BBC.
Oh, yeah.
If I could merge those two shows with my voice, that would be, that's the show that I want to make.
When do you start filming?
We're going to production after Drums On, so early June, and then I think the first episode is out late July, early August.
Oh, fantastic.
We haven't completely nailed the dates down yet, because Channel 4 talking about scheduling and who they want me to follow and all that sort of stuff. So we're still talking about that. And I said I need a bit of time after Ramadan because I've never done this before.
I
don't want to make it too close to Ramadan because Ramadan's not a good time for me to work.
Yeah, you don't need headspace.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not, my brain power is not 100%. So I thought, just give me 6 weeks. Just give me 6 weeks after Ramadan so we can really tackle this and really make the show that I can be proud of and then I can say I've had a fair shot at it.
Because
if the first episode comes on a week after Ramadan, I'm like, you haven't really given me a fair chance.
That's true. Yeah.
So give me a fair crack at this.
Yeah.
And I think they've agreed to that. So.
Sounds exciting. Can't wait for that.
But then again, there was also like that 11 o'clock slot with like the Big Nasty Show.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's not trained in this.
No.
But it was raw and it was incredibly...
Yeah.
It was great.
Such a fun show to watch. Mo's great. I know Mo. Mo Gilligan, who's on the show with him. He's great. And he's got his own show coming out in the summer as well. Really? I think it's called Motown. It might not be called that, but it's called something like that. Or it might just be called Mo's Show. And that's an attempt yet.
Right.
During the summer, he's got a 6 week run. So yeah, it's a very exciting time. It's a very exciting time.
Sorry.
I was going to ask you, have you done some comedy abroad in Europe?
You know, I'm going to Europe next weekend. I don't know when this is coming out, but the first weekend of May, I'm in Belgium, in Antwerp and Turnhout, and I performed in Utrecht, which is just outside Amsterdam, and I've done gigs in Berlin, and Brussels. So I'd like to do more. There's a burgeoning comedy circuit in Eastern Europe and like English speaking comedy in Eastern Europe and Scandinavia. So I'd like to do more of that. Definitely. Dubai and all these other places.
Oh yeah. Well, free holidays at Dubai, right?
Exactly. I hate Dubai, but you know, if you're paying for everything, then why
not? The way I describe Dubai is it's just a massive hot traffic centre.
Yes, you know what? That's good.
That's a perfect analogy.
Las Vegas without the soul.
Yeah.
And that's saying something.
Exactly.
There are parts of Dubai which I understand. I've been three times now. First time I went was for a friend's wedding. And last two times I went because my best friend lives there. And I get why people enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I get why people live there. I couldn't do it.
I completely agree because I kind of like did a mini boycott because of the way they treat brown people, right?
Yeah.
But I went for a tech conference because I'm a techie. And I'll be honest, it's a great little break if you want to go. It's the food's halal.
Yeah, if you can ignore the human rights issues and the way they treat and the way they indentured slavery of Asians, then it's a great place.
You made me feel really bad about that.
No. I've been three times. The last few times I've enjoyed myself. And also Fab Guys.
I
love Fab Guys, man.
Like Shake Shack and all of that. But Tez, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for taking the time out.
Well, thank you for having me. Just, the more that we can raise awareness and the more... I think the big thing is we need to influence and provide a space for the next generation who want to go into the arts.
Yes.
Ghazam and I talk about this all the time. It's like what we're doing will mean nothing if we're back here in 10 years' time talking about representation and stuff. And we want to make space for the next generation of artists, brown artists, male, female, you know, whatever they identify as, Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs, to go out there and tell the story that they want to tell and whether that's about their identity or not. But have that space to do it.
What kinds of things do you think that people of colour in the arts, like yourself and Gus Kahn and others, should be doing then to inspire young people?
I think it has to come from the top down and bottom up. So bottom up, we have to encourage our young people in our communities to pursue careers in arts, which they are actively discouraged to do so.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that be drama schools or photography courses or film school, or, you know, because I think there's a lot of talk about people in front of the camera, me and Gus or whatever. There's not a lot of talk about people behind the camera.
Yes. Yeah.
Both in production and in the boardroom.
Yeah.
So the person who commissioned my show at Channel 4 is called Saida. Not Sadia. Saida. Saida. And she's been great. She commissioned Big Nasty Show, Moth Show, My Show, and a couple of other things. And I think it just takes one person sometimes.
It does, yeah. To open that door.
And that's about representation again, having the representation behind the camera.
Off screen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We need the gatekeepers also to be on board with this, to also be diverse. And diversity doesn't mean colour. Mm. There's also diversity of thought.
Yeah.
So there's no point hiring 5 Indians who went to Cambridge. That's not diversity. What's the point? They're equally institutionalised.
Yeah. Hire the boys from Blackburn and Coventry.
Yes, exactly.
Absolutely. And Cheetham Hill.
Yes, and Cheetham Hill, yes. So what we can do is encourage youngsters to pursue careers in arts and encourage them to make things and put stuff out there. I mean, there's never been a better time because of YouTube and Instagram to just make stuff and put it out there, whether you're behind the camera or in front of the camera.
Yeah.
That is democratised arts. Mm-hmm. Like, whether it goes anywhere or not, you can do it. And people do, which is great. But also, we need that push from behind the camera as well, both in production and in the boardroom, to make those decisions and actively encourage people and be seen to be making space for those people to come and tell their stories. So yeah, there's a lot of it's better than it was when I started, but it's not quite there yet.
I think that's a great place to bring it to an end.
Yes, it's been absolutely fantastic.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, thank you for taking the time out, and it's really nice to meet you. You're actually really, I was a bit nervous thinking you might be a bit kind of, oh yeah, I'm a baller now, but you're actually really down to her.
From Blackburn, man.
I know. The same. Lancashire lad.
The same people.
Jazakallah khair, and we'll look, no, here's to your continued success, inshallah.
Amen.
So that was Tez. That was we really enjoyed that interview, didn't we, Sadia?
Oh, it was bants. It was good fun, bants. And like I said earlier on, he was super down to earth, super humble, and just, you know, you learn a lot from him.
Mm. I think what was interesting to hear was some of the things that go on, what he calls like the comedy circuit and the people that he's with, and some of the things that he and one of the key things that came out of it was we were discussing a lot about talking about his faith and identity in his comedy.
Yeah.
But he said he was very clear about Muslim comedian is not a genre of comedy.
And it's
ultimately about just being funny and having something to say and starting with your own story, which is really interesting. But ultimately, he's just a funny, funny guy.
He is. But with the flip side, on the flip side of the coin, at the same time as that, you know, without being reduced to being just a Muslim comedian, he's really strong in his Muslim identity, and, you know, he's quite loud about his Muslimness, which is, again, really important.
So we're really excited about our next couple of episodes, aren't we, Sadia? We've got a couple of really good guests joining us on the show.
We are indeed. I can't wait. I think we should keep our podcast listeners in suspense, though.
Yeah, yeah. It's not Riz, just so you know.
It might be a Riz, but it's not going to be the Riz that you're perhaps hoping for. But
that's true.
And equally as good Riz.
Definitely. Everyone's equal in our eyes. But Riz is next level. No favouritism, but in Riz, we called our product the Riz Test. So that's everything from us. Sadia, how can people get in touch with you?
So follow us on Twitter at the Riz Test. Follow us on, like us on Facebook, Instagram.
All of that. And what's your Twitter handle, Sadia?
It's at EDUC_research.
Yep, I'm Shaftag on Twitter at Shaftag. And you can get in hold of me there. You can also get hold of us both at hello@riztest.com. And we'll see you on the next episode.
Bye.